I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
There's growing anger in Queensland tonight after the police force delayed a decision on the future of an officer convicted of releasing the address of a domestic violence victim to her ex-husband.
The case of Neil Punchard has once again focused attention on how Queensland police deal with domestic and family violence.
We're taking domestic violence victim support groups totally by shock that a serving member of the Queensland police can be convicted of a crime and commit a crime while he's on duty and still be paid by taxpayers. 53-year-old Neil Punchard.
While a court has overturned his conviction on computer hacking charges, calls have grown for Punchard to be sacked.
Why hasn't he been sacked?
Well, the new Queensland Commissioner has said she'll take the time to investigate this issue and she'll look into it further, but she wants to respect the legal process and implications.
With the legal process now at an end, Queensland Police face new scrutiny over their decision to keep this officer on the payroll.
So the response from the victim tonight, Georgie?
She said that she'll never feel safe again and that the people that should protect her and that she should be able to trust, well, they gave away her details and risked her and her family's life. She actually complained to the police, to the Triple C.
Today, Julie's story and how police became part of the problem. It's Tuesday, the 15th of September. Ben, tell me about Julie.
Julie's not her real name. Julie is a survivor of a pretty horrific domestic violence experience.
Ben Smee is Guardian Australia's Queensland correspondent.
She has three kids, two to a former partner and one to a current husband. And I've been speaking to her for about 2 years, and I know her story inside out. Her interactions with the Queensland Police Service have been so shocking. They really question the whole setup of the Queensland Police, their whole approach and their attitude toward domestic violence victims from a, you know, really basic frontline level, but also an institutional level.
What can you tell us about what's happened to Julie?
The control started at the onset, the mind games. He'd say to me that I didn't know what I was talking about.
So Julie met her ex-husband. She refers to him as the perpetrator when she was about 19. He was 10 years older and had been married before.
I was too emotional. I was wrong. My view would not be taken on board.
She says because she was so young and she came from a family where men treated women well. She didn't notice the red flags that we really now understand are worrying signs when it comes to domestic violence.
The man was in charge and the woman was not valuable, just a slave, basically.
So this isn't Julie's voice. This is a voice actor reading a transcript of what Julie said to me.
As time went on, the control got even worse. Control of spending, checking the car, where I was going. When I go to work, he would just show up. He wanted to know where I was 24/7. He'd check my phone, check what I was doing on the computer.
Then there was physical abuse. Julie told me about a number of incidents over a number of years.
On my wedding night, he pushed me up against the wall because I said something he didn't like. I just wanted to run away. He'd hit me when I was pregnant. And after he'd physically attacked me when my son was very ill, I thought he had broken my neck. My body just went numb.
Julie said she left the relationship after an incident when the perpetrator threw her eldest son into a wall.
I said to myself, that is it. This can never happen again. That's when I grabbed my children. He grabbed me with a knife and said, I'll effing kill you. I still remember his eyes. They were black. I basically left with nothing but a bag of clothes. And during our time together, we had bought a house and had two successful businesses. I walked out on everything and had to restart.
As we unfortunately know, Ben, because so much of the evidence tells us this, One of the most dangerous times for a woman is when she's trying to leave an abusive relationship. What happened to Julie once she left?
Julie experienced that typical response where the perpetrator continued his abusive behaviour, his controlling behaviour.
There were days that he called at least 100 times and left abusive messages. He was stalking me, he was following me, he was calling and texting everyone I knew, defaming me, to control the way other people saw me.
And then it was the perpetrator who ultimately started a custody dispute.
I didn't start the custody dispute, he did, because that was another way for him to inflict abuse on me and control.
This is where the police officer, Neil Punchard, enters the story.
Who is Neil Punchard?
At the time all this was happening, in about 2013, Neil Punchard was a senior constable with the Queensland Police. He was a traffic cop. He's a childhood friend of the perpetrator in this instance, and Punchard supported him through the custody dispute, through the initial family court proceedings. He showed up at hearings and he even provided a written reference to the court on his behalf, stating that I am a police officer and this is my experience of him, essentially taking his side in this whole process.
That must be quite chilling to see a police officer who you rely on to protect you defending your abuser in court.
I think especially given what we know about domestic abuse and family abuse is that in circumstances when relationships do break down, the perpetrator seeks to exercise control by trying to frame the other person as if they are the one in the wrong. It's extremely inappropriate for a police officer to become involved in those sorts of proceedings in that way. But that's not even the worst of what happened. As a police officer, Neil Punchard has access to databases that contain a huge amount of sensitive information about individual citizens. Things like the criminal history, intelligence reports, flags on them, addresses, phone numbers, pretty much every interaction you could have with a government agency can ultimately be accessed via these police systems. Now, because this data is so sensitive, access is restricted and police officers are really only supposed to use it for official purposes. They're told about the conditions when they access those systems. They're told not to access them for personal reasons. And every time the system's used, there's a warning screen that pops up that tells officers that they really should only be using it for official purposes. Neil Punchard logged into this computer system. He accessed Julie's address. He passed it on to his friend, the perpetrator. This is computer hacking, and it's illegal. Punchard then texted the address to the perpetrator, and he said, "Just tell her you know where she lives and leave it at that. Lol. She will fucking explode. LMAO, or laughing my ass off."
Oh, my God. That's obviously really shocking, Ben. Did Punchard know at the time that his friend had been abusive to Julie?
He claims not to have known.
Okay, so what about Julie? How did she find out about all of this?
From Julie's point of view, she became aware that the perpetrator had her address and she was forced to move house. She didn't know that Punchard had accessed the system at the time, and it wasn't until a few years later, in 2016, that she found an old phone belonging to her but that the perpetrator had been using. And she found some old text messages between the man and Neil Punchard.
So what did she do?
Julie went to the Queensland Crime and Corruption Commission, believing it was the appropriate place to make a complaint about a police officer. In 98% of cases, if you go to the Crime and Corruption Commission, it ultimately gets sent back to the agency that you've complained about. And in this case, like in most cases where there's a complaint about police then investigate their own. They initially took internal disciplinary action against Punchard, and his pay was docked roughly $10 a week for about a year. They decided to keep the matter in-house. They didn't pursue criminal charges for computer hacking despite it being an offence and despite Punchard admitting privately that he had done so. Now, by this point, Julie's faith in police is understandably shaken. By her experience in trying to hold Neil Punchard to account, but also her own interactions with the police as she tried to seek a domestic violence order as part of trying to make herself and her family safe.
Police said to me, "Do you really need one?" I said, "Excuse me? I'm in fear of my life." I said, "Why do you say that?" And they said, "Because every man, woman and dog wants a DV order." And I said, "I'm not every man, woman and dog. I'm a person and I need genuine help immediately."
You essentially need to go to court to get a domestic violence order. Most applications are brought by the police and the police have a part to play in the process, but ultimately it's an order that is imposed by a court.
I said, "I fear I could be murdered because this person has fantasized about the way he wishes to kill me in great detail. And to the children, they also fear for their lives. I need your help. I have nowhere else to go."
She eventually did get a domestic violence protection order. But Julie said that dealing with police, particularly as they were investigating Neil Punchard, was a real ordeal.
They were just on team police. They didn't care what I'd gone through or what I had to say to them. It was about protecting the police. It should not be that hard for a woman wanting to stay alive and save herself for her children.
Julie sought compensation from the Queensland Police Force for the breach of privacy that caused her to move house and incur a huge number of costs. She went to a people's court in Queensland, the Civil and Administrative Tribunal, where most people, including her, turn up self-represented. Queensland Police briefed a Silk, a senior barrister, and the case dragged on for about 18 months. The police then appealed a finding that they were liable for the breach of her privacy. And Julie, fighting this case entirely self-represented, eventually won and won a payout.
Were there any other dealings with police?
Over the years, Julie has had a number of other incidents in terms of dealing with police. For example, her new husband was assaulted by the perpetrator in a McDonald's car park. She confirmed with the McDonald's store that the footage could be saved, but afterwards police told her they just weren't able to recover it. Then another time, police taped over evidence of an alleged confrontation that happened inside a courthouse. Julie complained the same day that the incident happened, and it took police 3 weeks to get around to even requesting the footage. When she complained about that bungle, an officer, this is her point of contact as a domestic violence victim, told her that she should not contact him again about her petty domestic violence matter.
Oh, both these incidents sound like pretty big police failings, Ben. Have they explained why this has happened?
Not really, not adequately, not in a way that has ever really satisfied Julie. Having spoken to her at length, having listened to some of these interactions, what is really clear is that they simply struggle to deal with someone who has responded to her trauma, has responded to being let down time and again by police with anger, with a sense of injustice. It's as if she's not tragic enough for them, that they expect a domestic violence victim to be sufficiently beaten down by the process. The fact that she carries herself with poise, that she's stoic, that she has showed great determination to continue to fight back whenever she's experienced something, I think is something that police haven't responded very well to.
Could this be a lack of training on police's part, since we know that no victim of trauma responds the same? There's no one typical victim of any kind of trauma, let alone one typical victim of domestic violence.
Well, absolutely. And I think that listening to those interactions makes very clear that police don't necessarily have a great deal of time and patience for her. They see her as a problem. They see her as someone who is out to make their lives difficult. And the fact that they can't recognize exactly that people respond to trauma in different ways, that people respond to being let down by the police in very different ways, absolutely exposes a lack of understanding about the way those sorts of things work.
Okay, and back to Punchard. He had some minor disciplinary action taken against him after an internal police investigation. Is that the end of this for him?
Julie had been remarkable at bringing public pressure to bear on the Queensland Police Commissioner at the time, Ian Stewart, to reopen the case. He had the Crime and Corruption Commission re-examine it. They made a call that ultimately Punchard should have been charged, and eventually he was charged with 9 counts of computer hacking and ordered to face court in late 2018.
And what happened with that case?
Punchard pleaded guilty to those 9 counts of computer hacking. In the Brisbane Magistrates Court, he was sentenced to 2 months in prison, wholly suspended and convicted, which is something that essentially means that he is at risk of losing his job. Punchard appealed the severity of the sentence, and earlier this month, the Queensland District Court overturned the sentence. They gave him 140 hours of community service and decided not to record a conviction.
Do we know why that conviction was overturned?
Well, there are a number of reasons given in the judgment. The fact that Punchard had already been disciplined by the Queensland Police Service. The fact Punchard had some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder at the time. The fact that senior police officers gave character references speaking to his otherwise good character. He also said he took into account Punchard's age, which was 54, and the likelihood that he would be able to gain any other employment if sacked from the Queensland Police Service. These are the sorts of things that I think are taken into account when anyone is sentenced, and there were the reasons in this case that were given by the court. The result of that most recent court hearing is ultimately very disappointing for Julie, and there is a bigger issue that exists as a result, which is whether the police have the ability to fire the officer, given that the court has decided not to record a conviction and given that they took the initial really inadequate disciplinary action when the first complaint was made.
The fact that they haven't sacked him, it's outrageous. What kind of message is that sending?
I'm not sure I follow, Ben. What does the conviction have to do with whether the police can fire him if they had already found that he actually did access this information inappropriately?
Essentially, the police discipline system is set up to mainly give officers remedial actions. They don't necessarily get disciplined in the majority of cases. It's also notoriously difficult in Queensland to fire a police officer, even one who may have acted in the way that Punchard has. Conviction, as I understand it, and is something that's been put before the court, would have really given police the grounds to simply dismiss him. The fact that they potentially don't means that they're now seeking legal advice, and we're in a very difficult situation where there are some strong calls for him to be sacked, but I think the police aren't really even at this stage sure whether they can take that sort of an action against him.
Commissioner, thanks for your time. This week marks 1 year. Does it feel like it's been a baptism of fire in some ways?
I can say that it definitely has gone very, very quickly. In some sense, yes, a baptism of fire. It's been an incredible 12 months.
Ben, this is a pretty outrageous case. What have the Queensland Police said about Julie's case? And have they said anything about their approach to domestic violence more broadly?
So the new police commissioner, Katerina Carroll, has done a series of interviews.
And who would have thought in 2020 that we would be policing social distancing?
She's on the circuit again this week in the wake of the Neil Punchard decision, and she talks about wanting to make domestic violence a focus of her tenure.
So, yeah, this year has been terrible in terms of the deaths. The same week that Hannah Clark passed away and her children, we also had another domestic violence death, and we also had one, you know, just 2 weeks ago in Rockhampton. And I would say absolutely horrific.
She's talked about the impact that the murder of Hannah Clark and her three children had on her, you know, at a very early stage in her tenure as police commissioner, and how she really wants to kind of tackle the scourge of domestic violence.
What we're finding is that it's once again a small cohort of people that are actually incredibly difficult to deal with. And there is no silver bullet in any of this. It's a combination of many things, many strategies, initiatives, you know, relationships with departments, a relationship with the community, all of us pulling together to make this happen.
Which all sounds great, except for the fact that all of these kind of pronouncements seem really, really light on the actual detail. Now, the cases that I've written about, particularly Julie's case, expose problems with the police culture around domestic violence, with police attitudes and understanding of what constitutes domestic violence.
We can do a lot to assist with the safety of victims and prevent further issues, but we together have to work a lot earlier in people's lives to prevent it from happening in the first place.
Now, we've asked Carol to sit down repeatedly to talk about these things, about how she plans to address them, to trying to get to some of the substance behind those sorts of umbrella statements that she makes about wanting to deal with domestic violence. And those interview requests have all been quite politely declined.
When I see police stand up and say, enough is enough, I know it's a marketing ploy. I haven't seen that support. They say it's something they care about, but where are the actions that back that up?
So is this a cultural problem within the force then?
Absolutely, it's a cultural problem. Punchard is the most egregious case, and he remains a serving Queensland police officer. He's suspended, but he's still on full pay and he still has not been sacked. You know, that is a problem for every victim of domestic violence who may be wondering whether they can trust a police officer. We know that over the last 5 years, 84 current police officers have been accused of domestic violence offences. Now, when police respond to that sort of a statement, they say things like, well, no domestic violence is acceptable, but we understand that police officers are, you know, a member of the community and that domestic violence exists within the community. And when you talk to victims, when you talk to people from domestic violence support services, this is where the problem really exists. Police don't seem to even acknowledge that they hold that special place within society, that they're the people that we need to trust, that victims of domestic and family violence need to trust to be able to tell their stories, to be able to trust to protect them in those sorts of situations. So if a woman doesn't have confidence to go into a police station and to report domestic violence, and that they're not going to get a police officer at the front desk who themselves might have been accused, that they're not going to run into Neil Punchard at a police station, that, you know, that is the problem. And police absolutely need to be held to a higher standard because we place this immense trust in them as the ones to deal with domestic violence situations. That if we can't trust them, then that's a huge problem that reverberates right through the community. And it will stop any attempt from the commissioner to deal with domestic violence before it even begins.
Whenever you walk into a police station, you do a mystery shop. You talk about DV, nobody cares. Domestic violence, if we're going to take it seriously, something needs to change, and it needs to change from the top. The system is failing women and children.
So from all your years of reporting on this and the experts you've spoken to and the domestic violence groups, What do they say needs to change?
Well, the Women's Legal Service in Queensland have been calling for some time for an audit of police officer attitudes toward domestic violence, so we can kind of get a baseline understanding of how we need to educate police, how we need to get them to understand that domestic violence is, you know, maybe not necessarily just physical violence, but it can involve the sort of intimidation that we know happened in Julie's case, the sort of controlling behaviour that happened in Julie's case. That's something that hasn't happened, that the police haven't really even responded to. You know, they're the ones who deal with women who come in time and time and time again, who say their complaints haven't been dealt with seriously enough. But I think at a base level, what needs to change is that people need to know that police are there to protect them, that they can trust them. And I really think that unless the police commissioner is able to do that and demonstrate that police are trustworthy, that police who have problematic attitudes towards domestic violence aren't going to be in the uniform, then, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle.
I cannot give out my address to any government agency or put myself on the electoral roll so I can vote, because the police have access to that.
And what's happening in Julie's life now?
The perpetrator in Julie's case has actually fled overseas. There are warrants out for his arrest for breaches of domestic violence orders. He has been convicted of breaches of domestic violence orders. The fact that he's overseas, though, doesn't really take the fear out of the situation that she faces. He could come back at any moment. It's unlikely that if he did come back that he would immediately be convicted or, you know, just automatically locked up. So she has to live with this fear that if he does come back, who does she turn to for protection?
I have to practice extreme vigilance. All of the things I've had to do now have become a habit, like looking over my shoulder, locking my doors when I get to the car, or running to the car. I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, constantly in fear.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, Australia's Domestic and Family Violence Counselling Service can be reached on 1800 RESPECT. That's 1800 737 732. Thanks to Julie so much for sharing her story with us, and to Ben Smee for his time. You can read more of his reporting at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater and Joe Koning, with assistance from Miles Herbert. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. That's it for today. See you tomorrow.